all goes wrong. He gets horribly lost. And the more he drives around the town, the more he attracts the attention of the population. Crowds assail him at every turn. At one sharp corner, as his hands frenetically wrestle with the steerage wheel, he stalls once again. The multitude of the curious and the offended descends upon him. He starts the automobile well enough, despite the crowd. He even feels that he can get it into first gear. Then he looks at the steerage wheel and has no idea in which direction he is supposed to turn it. In trying to satisfy the fiendish angle of the street he was attempting to get onto, he turned the wheel several times before stalling. He tries to determine the matter logically. This way? That way? But he cannot come to any conclusion. He notices a plump man in his 50s standing on the sidewalk, level with the automobile's headlights. He's better dressed than the others. Tomas leans out and calls to him above the din of the engine.
"Excuse me, sir. I need your help, if you would be so kind. I'm having a mechanical problem. It's something complicated I won't bore you with. But tell me, is the wheel there, the one right in front of you, is it turning?"
The man backs away and looks down at the wheel. Tomas grabs the steerage wheel and turns it. With the automobile completely at rest, it takes real effort.
"Well," Tomas puffs loudly, "is it turning?"
The man looks puzzled.
"Turning? No. If it were turning, your carriage would be moving."
"I mean, is it turning the other way?"
The man looks to the rear of the automobile.
"The other way? No, no, it's not moving that way either. It's not moving at all."
Many in the crowd nod in agreement.
"I'm sorry, I'm not making myself clear. I'm not asking if the wheel turned on itself in a round way, like a cartwheel. Rather, did it..."
He searches for the right words.
"Did it turn on the spot on its tiptoes, like a ballerina, so to speak?"
The man stares at the wheel doubtfully. He looks to his neighbors, left and right, but they don't venture any opinion either. Tomas turns the steerage wheel again with brutal force.
"Is there any movement at all from the wheel? Any at all?"
he shouts. The man shouts in return, with many in the crowd joining in.
"Yes, yes, I see it. There is movement."
A voice cries,
"Your problem is solved."
The crowd bursts into cheers and applause. Tomas wishes they would go away. His helper, the plump man, says it again, pleased with himself.
"There was movement, more than the last time."
Tomas signals to him with his hand to come closer. The man sidles over only a little.
That's good," says Tomas. "I'm most grateful for your help."
The man ventures no reaction beyond a single calisthenic blink and the vaguest nodding. If a broken egg were resting atop his bald head, the yolk might wobble a little.
"But tell me," Tomas pursues, leaning forward and speaking emphatically, "which way did the wheel turn?"
"Which way?" the man repeats.
"Yes, did the wheel turn to the left, or did it turn to the right?"
The man lowers his eyes and swallows visibly. A heavy silence spreads through the crowd as it waits for his response.
"Left or right?"
Tomas asks again, leaning closer still, attempting to establish a manner of complicity with the man. The egg yolk wobbles. There is a pause in which the whole town holds its breath.
"I don't know,"
the plump man finally cries in a high-pitched voice, spilling the yolk. He pushes his way through the crowd and bolts. The sight of the ungainly, bandy-legged town notable racing down the street dumbfounds Tomas. He has lost his only ally. A man speaks out.
"It could have been left. It could have been right. Hard to tell."
Murmurs of agreement rise up. The crowd seems cooler now, its indulgence turning to edginess. He has lifted his foot off the pedal and the engine has died. He gets out and turns the starting handle. he pleads with the crowd in front of the machine.
Listen to me, please. This machine will move. It will jump. For the sake of your children, for your own sake, please move away. I beg you. This is a most dangerous device. Step back.
A man next to him addresses him quietly.
Oh, here comes Demetrio and his mother. She's not one you want to cross.
Who's Demetrio?
Tomas asks.
He's the village idiot, but so nicely dressed by his mother.
Tomas looks up the street and sees the town notable returning. He's weeping, his face covered in glistening tears. Holding his hand, pulling him along, is a very small woman dressed in black. She's holding a club. Her eyes are fixed on Tomas. The way she's straining at the end of her son's arm, she looks like a tiny dog trying to hurry its leisurely owner along. Tomas returns to the driver's seat and grapples with the machine's controls. He humors the machine into not pouncing forward. As he plies the pedals, it growls but only leans forward, like an enormous boulder that has lost the tiny pebble that holds it back, but hasn't yet gone crashing down the slope to destroy the village below. The crowd gasps and instantly creates a space all around. He presses a touch harder on the accelerator pedal. He prepares to twist the steerage wheel with mania in whatever direction his instincts will choose, hoping it will be the correct direction, when he is confounded to see that the steerage wheel is turning on its own, of its own will, and it proves to be turning the right way. The vehicle creeps forward and finishes clearing the turn onto the cross street. He would continue to stare in wonderment if he didn't hear the clanging sound of a wooden club striking metal.
"You dare to make fun of my son!"
cries the mother of the broken egg. She has clocked one of the headlights with such force that it has cleanly broken off. He is horrified, his uncle's jewel.
"I am going to suffocate you up a sheep's ass!"
The machine has conveniently brought its hood level with the aggrieved mother. Up goes the club, down goes the club. With a mighty crash, a valley appears on the hood. Tomas would push harder on the accelerator pedal, but there are still many people close by.
"Please, I implore you, hold your club," he calls out.
Now the side light is within her easy reach. Another swing. In a glass-shattering explosion, it flies off. The madwoman, whose son persists with his inconsolable blubbering, is winding up her club again.
"I'll feed you to a dog and then eat that dog," she shrieks.
Tomas pushes hard on the accelerator pedal. The woman narrowly misses the side mirror. Her club instead shatters the window of the door to the cabin. In a roar, he and the injured automobile leap forth and escape Ponte de Sor. A few kilometers onward, next to a growth of bushes, he brings the machine to a standstill. He gets out and gazes at the automobile's amputations. He clears the glass shards from the cabin. His uncle will be livid at what has been done to the pride of his menagerie. Just ahead is the village of Rosmaninal. Is that not one of the villages he mocked for its obscurity?
"Rosmaninal, you can do me no harm," he had boasted.
Will the village now make him pay for his arrogance? He prepares for yet another night sleeping in the machine. This time he supplements his uncle's coat with a blanket. He extracts the precious diary from the trunk and opens it at random. "The sun brings no solace, nor does sleep. Food no longer sates me, nor the company of men. Merely to breathe is to display an optimism I do not feel." Tomas breathes deeply, finding optimism where Father Ulysses could not. Strange how this diary of misery brings him such joy. Poor Father Ulysses! He had such high hopes arriving on Sao Tome. Before his energies were depleted by disease, solitary and without purpose, he spent much of his time wandering and watching. There seems to be no purpose to these rambles other than the working off of despair. Better to be desperate and itinerant than desperate and sitting in an overheated hut. And what he saw, he wrote down. Today a slave asked me, signified to me, if my leather shoes were made from the skin of an African. They are of the same color. Was the man also eaten? Were his bones reduced to useful powder? Some of the Africans believe that we Europeans are cannibals. The notion is the result of their incredulity at the use they are put to, field labor. In their experience, the material part of one's life, what we would call the earning of it, demands no great effort. Tending a vegetable garden in the tropics takes little time and occupies few hands. Hunting is more demanding, but is a group activity and source of some pleasure, and the effort is not begrudged. Why then would the white man take so many of them if they didn't have ulterior motives greater than gardening? I reassured the slave that my shoes were not made of his fellow's skin. I cannot say I convinced him. Tomas knows what the slaves and Father Ulysses cannot. The unending demands of the sugarcane fields of Brazil and, later, of the cotton fields of America. A man or a woman may not need to work so hard to live, but a cog in a system must turn ceaselessly. No matter their provenance, what territory, what tribe, the slaves soon sink to the same saturnine behavior. They become lethargic, passive, indifferent. The more the overseers exert themselves to change this behavior, freely using the whip, the more it becomes ingrained. Of the many signs of hopelessness the slaves manifest, the one that strikes me the most is geophagy. They paw the ground like dogs, gather a round ball, open their mouths, chew it and swallow it. I cannot decide if eating of the Lord's humus is unchristian. Tomas turns his head and looks at the darkening fields around him. To be miserable upon the land, and then to eat it? Later, Father Ulysses records trying it himself. A darkness blooms in me, a choking algae of the soul. I chew slowly. It does not taste bad, only is unpleasant on the teeth. How much longer, Lord? How much longer? I feel unwell, and see in the eyes of others that I am worse. Walking to town exhausts me. I go to the bay instead and stare out at the waters.
Whatever it was that afflicted Father Ulysses, and Europeans in Africa had their unhappy choice of ailments, malaria, dysentery, respiratory illnesses, heart troubles, anemia, hepatitis, leprosy, and syphilis, among others, in addition to malnutrition. It was slowly and painfully killing him. Tomas falls asleep thinking of his son, and of how sometimes at night, after an evening at his uncle's house, he would slip into Dora's room in the servants' quarters. She might be asleep already after a long day of work. Then he would take sleeping Gaspar into his arms and hold him. Amazing how the two could sleep through any disturbance. He would hold his limp son and sing to him softly, nearly hoping he would wake so they could play. He is woken the next morning by the itching of his head and chest. He rises and methodically scratches himself. His fingernails have rims of blackness under them. It has been 5 days since he has washed. He must find an inn soon, with a good bed and a hot bath. Then he remembers the next village he must cross, the one he scorned. It is fear of Rosmaninal that pushes him to enter third gear that day, the automobile's mechanical pinnacle. He has barely started off when he works the machine into second gear. With the grimmest lack of hesitation, he repeats the hand-and-foot maneuver,
pushing the change speed lever farther than he has ever pushed it before. The dial on the instrument board blinks in disbelief. The automobile becomes pure velocity. Third gear is the fire of the internal combustion engine coming into itself and becoming an external combustion engine, thundering through the countryside like a meteorite. Yet, oddly, third gear is quieter than second gear, as if even sound cannot keep up with the machine. The wind howls around the driving compartment. Such is the swiftness of the machine that the telegraph poles along the road shift and begin to appear as close together as teeth in a comb. As for the landscape beyond the poles, none of it is to be seen. It flits by like a panic-stricken school of fish. In the blurry land of high velocity, Tomas is aware of only two things, the roaring and rattling frame of the automobile and the road straight ahead, so hypnotic in its allure that it's like a fishing line upon whose hook he is caught. Though he is in the open country, his mental focus is such that he might as well be driving through a tunnel. In a daze, barely cognizant in the ambient din, he worries about lubrication. He imagines a small engine part going dry, heating up, bursting into flames, then the whole machine exploding in an iridescent conflagration of moto-naphtha-fueled blues, oranges, and reds. Nothing bursts into flames. The automobile only clangs, balls, and eats up the road with terrifying appetite. If there is evil resident in Rosmaninov, indeed, if there is good resident in Rosmaninov, he sees none of it. The village vanishes in a streak. He sees a figure, a man, a woman, turn to look in his direction and fall over. It is some kilometers past Rosmaninov that he comes upon the stagecoach. His uncle warned him about these, did he not? Tomas slows down and thinks of holding back until an alternate route suggests itself or the coach turns off. But he grows impatient on the solitary country road. There is no comparison between the 30 horses galloping in his machine and the 4 horses cantering ahead of the coach. He pushes down on the accelerator pedal. With a choke, a cough, and a shudder, the machine grips the road with greater determination. He feels his hands pulled forward while his head is pushed back. The distance between automobile and stagecoach begins to shrink. He sees a man's head appear from the top of the coach. The man waves at him. A moment later, the coach, which has been somewhat on the right side of the road, heaves to its center. Is this the reason behind his uncle's warning about stagecoaches, their erratic weaving? He rather interprets the move as a courtesy, the stagecoach moving aside to let him go by, like a gentleman allowing a lady first passage through a doorway. The man's wave reinforces this interpretation in his mind. He urges the automobile on. He navigates into the space to the right of the stagecoach. Every part of the machine is shaking. The passengers in the stagecoach, which is wildly rocking to and fro and side to side, hold on to the edge of the windows and crane their necks to look at him, gawking with a number of expressions, curiosity, amazement, fear, disgust. The two drivers of the stagecoach come into view, his colleagues in a way, and he eases off the accelerator pedal. The stagecoach drivers and he will greet each other like sea captains whose ships are crossing paths. He has read a great many captains' logbooks in the course of his investigations. The way stagecoach and automobile are pitching and rolling has something maritime to it. He lifts a hand, ready to wave, a smile building upon his face. He looks up at the stagecoach drivers and is shocked at what he sees. If the passengers had a number of expressions on their faces, the drivers have only one, out-and-out loathing. The man who turned and waved at him earlier, or was he in fact shaking his fist, is barking and growling at him like a dog, and is making as if to leap from his seat down onto the roof of the machine. The man doing the driving looks even more incensed. His face is red with anger, and his mouth is open in a continuous shout. He is brandishing a long whip, spurring his horses on. The whip rises and coils in the air like a serpent before coming down and flattening out with a sharp and piercing snap that goes off like a gun. Only then does Tomas realize that the steeds have been pushed to full thundering gallop. He can feel the ground beneath him shaking from their efforts. Despite the cushioning of the automobile's rubber wheels and the mediation of the suspension springs, the hard, marvelous work of the horses rattles his bones and awes his brain. In relative terms, he is slowly passing the stagecoach, the way a man on a street might overtake an elderly walker, with such ease and comfort that he has the leisure to tip his hat and say a kind word. But from the point of view of someone standing by the side of the road, both he and the stagecoach are hurtling through space at a fantastic speed, as if the elderly walker and the man on the street were advancing on the roofs of two express trains racing on parallel tracks. The silence that enveloped him as a result of his intense concentration suddenly explodes into the hammering of the galloping horse's hooves, the screaming creaking of the swaying stagecoach, the shouting of the drivers, the shrill distress of the frightened passengers, the cracking of the whip, and the roar of the automobile. He presses the accelerator pedal as hard as he can. The automobile surges ahead, but slowly. A further noise, keen and metallic, stabs his ears. The driver has turned his whip off the horses and is now lashing the roof of the automobile. Tomas grimaces as if the lashes were striking his own back. The driver's assistant has his arms raised. Above his head is a wooden chest with metal strappings. It looks heavy. The man hurls it at the automobile, and it hits the roof like a bomb, followed by scraping sounds as the chest and its contents slide off. The horses, less than a meter away from Tomas, are kicking up a storm of dirt and throwing off quantities of froth from their mouths. Their eyes bulge with terror. They veer closer. The driver is steering them into the automobile. "Death is upon me," thinks Tomas. The horses give out just as the automobile reaches its full speed. The machine moves ahead decisively, and he is able to steady it and bring it back to the center of the road, clipping the right lead horse so closely that he sees in the side mirror that it has to rear up its head to avoid hitting the back of the cabin. The moment he is ahead, the exhausted horses falter to a halt. Behind him, the drivers continue to shout. In the side mirror, he watches the passengers pour out of the stagecoach as they and the drivers direct their shouting and gesturing at each other. He feels shattered by the encounter and wants to stop. But fear of the stagecoach catching up drives him on. As his unhappy ship forges ahead, he focuses on the road again. His stomach is as turbulent as a stormy sea. He squirms with itchiness. He considers his situation. How many days has he been driving? He thinks and counts. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 nights. 4 nights and 5 days of his allotment of 10. Only 10 days, and he is not even out of the province of Ribatejo, not a quarter of the way to his destination. How did he imagine that he could complete his mission in so few days? The notion is laughable. He was lured by the promise of his uncle's magic carpet. The chief curator of the Museum of Ancient Art will not tolerate him being late. If he misses even a single day of work, he will be fired, plain and simple. That is the work world he lives in, one where he is an insignificant, replaceable cog. His relations with the chief curator, the collections manager, and the other curators at the museum are no better than Father Ulysses' relations were with the bishop and the island clergy. How happy is a work environment where colleagues never eat together, but rather sit in sour isolation. Sometimes he feels he can match every misery that Father Ulysses experienced on São Tomé with one he has experienced at the museum. The same tedium, the same solitary nature of the work, broken by tense encounters with others, the same physical discomfort, in his case the unending days spent in damp and musty basement storage rooms or hot and dusty attics, the same choking misery, the same floundering attempt to make sense of things. I find small shrines on the plantations set up in remote locations. They are crudely made of wood or baked mud, with shells and rotting fruit lying about them. If they be destroyed, and it is not I who does so, they reappear somewhere else. I am pleased to come upon these shrines. The slaves who, in their native villages, practice various crafts, do nothing here except the compulsory field work, no metal work, no woodwork, no basket weaving, no ornament making, no tailoring, no body painting, no singing, nothing. On this green island of malefic riot, they are as productive as mules. Only in these shrines do I see a vestige of their former lives, a reach for pregnancy. Tomas is assailed by doubt. Is his own quest a reach for pregnancy? He imagines that Gaspar would be taken by Father Ulysses' gift, given his childish sensibility. But he doubts Dora would approve. That has always tormented him, that in the service of frank truth he would do something that would upset her. But the treasure exists. He is only bringing to light what is already there. He pleads with Dora in his mind, begs for her forgiveness. It is an elevation of all creation, my love. No, no, there is no desecration. But he knows Dora would not believe him, that he would lose the argument. He still does not dare to halt the machine, so he weeps and drives at the same time. Outside the village of Atalaya, he finally stops. He climbs on a mudguard to assess the damage done to the roof of the machine. The sight is dispiriting. There is an enormous dent caused by the thrown chest, and the whip, expertly deployed, has done its own extensive damage. The bright burgundy paint of the roof is veined with cracks. Great chips of it are ready to come off. When he looks inside the cabin, he sees that the cedar panels of the ceiling have split and jut out like broken bones. He walks into Atalaya, looking for Motonaptha. He finds a small shop that sells a bit of everything. After he lists the various sobriquets of the fuel, the shop owner nods her head and produces a small bottle. He asks for more. The shop owner is surprised. But what? An automobile doesn't run on mere cupfuls of sustenance. An automobile is an insatiable fiend. He gets all she has. Two bottles. Back at the automobile, as he is feeding the hungry beast the bottles of Motonaptha he has gathered so far, he casually inspects an empty bottle's label. He starts. A lice and flea product. Guaranteed to kill all vermin and their eggs in a pitiless fashion, the label claims. Apply liberally. Do not ingest. Keep away from flames. Could the shop owners and apothecaries not have asked him why he needed so many bottles of the foul liquid? What he bought as fuel for the machine, they sold as a parasite killer. They thought he was a tornado of vermin, with a civilization of lice, fleas, and whatnot dancing upon his head. No wonder they looked at him askance. He holds still. But of course, there is no other explanation. The shop owners and apothecaries are right. He is itchy all over, in a manner that is absolutely maddening, precisely because he is a tornado of vermin, with a civilization of lice, fleas, and whatnot dancing upon his head. He looks at his other hand. The bottle he is holding upside down has just gurgled itself empty. It was his last bottle. How many did he have? 15 or so. He's had bottles of the stuff practically since the beginning of his trip, clinking away in the cabin, besides a whole barrel of it. Now he has none of it, or none that he can get to. He grabs the tank's small, round opening, as if he could stretch it out. He can't. Between his suffering and its relief, a bathtub of it, there lies a narrow doorway that will not open. He wonders, who touched me? Who touched my clothes? Who passed on the infestation? The point of contact must have been either in Povo de Santa Iria or Ponte de Sor. In both places he rubbed shoulders, indeed he rubbed against entire bodies, while rescuing the machine from the surrounding masses. He expends himself in a frenzy of scratching. The sky darkens, it begins to rain, and he takes refuge in the automobile. The front window of the automobile becomes so streaked and marbled with drops of water that he has difficulty seeing through them to the road. As the rain grows to a steady downpour, he wonders. His uncle said nothing about the machine's ability to operate in the rain. He does not trust it to stay on the road. He will wait the rain out. Dusk and then darkness come on like a miasma. In his sleep, stagecoaches are galloping down on him from all directions. He is cold. His feet protrude over the edge of the driving compartment, and the rain soaks them. Itchiness periodically rouses him. In the morning, the rain is still coming down. He is too chilled to want to wash in it. He no more than wets a hand to wipe his face. His only comfort comes from remembering that Father Ulysses was plagued by rain on the island. There it deluged with such insistence that minds became unhinged. By comparison, what is this mild European drizzle? On this deserted road, only the odd peasant appears, inevitably stopping for an extended conversation. Some arrive along the road, alone or pulling a donkey, while others come off the land itself, peasant lords working their tiny fiefdoms. None of them seems to mind the rain. From one peasant to the next, the reaction is the same. They inspect the vehicle's wheels, finding them dainty and small. They peer at the side mirrors, finding them ingenious. They gaze at the machine's controls, finding them intimidating. They stare at the machine's engine, finding it unfathomable. Each deems the whole a marvel. Only one, a shepherd, seems to have no interest in the contraption.
"Can I sit with you for a while?" he asks. "I am cold and wet."
Already his sheep are surrounding the vehicle, held hostage there by a small dog that races around and yips incessantly. The sheep's bleating is constant and grating. Tomas nods to the man, who walks around to the other side of the vehicle and clambers in next to him in the driving compartment. Tomas wishes that he would speak, but the crusty man says not a word, only gazes ahead. Minutes go by. The silence is framed by the steady hiss of the rain, the bleating of the sheep, and the yipping of the dog. Finally, it is Tomas who speaks.
"Let me tell you why I am traveling. It's been a difficult journey so far. I'm searching for a lost treasure. I've spent a year determining where it might be, and now I know. Or I nearly know. I'm close. When I find it, I'll take it to the National Museum of Ancient Art in Lisbon, but it would be worthy of a great museum in Paris or London. The thing in question, it's... well, I can't tell you what it is, but it's an impressive object. People will stare at it, their mouths open. It will cause an uproar. With this object, I'll give God his comeuppance for what he did to the ones I love."
The old rube's sole response is to glance at him and nod. Otherwise, only the sheep seem to appreciate his momentous confession with a blast of wavering baas. The flock is no creamy billow of fluffy sheepdom. These creatures have bony faces, bulging eyes, ragged fleeces, and rear ends caked with excrement.
"Tell me," he asks the shepherd, "what do you think of animals?"
The shepherd once again glances at him, but this time he speaks.
"What animals?"
"Well, these, for example," Tomas replies. "What do you think of your sheep?"
At length, the man says,
"They are my living."
Tomas thinks for a moment.
Yes, you're living. You make a profound point there. Without your sheep, you would have no livelihood. You would die. This dependency creates a sort of equality, doesn't it? Not individually, but collectively. As a group, you and your sheep are at opposite ends of a seesaw, and somewhere in between there is a fulcrum. You must maintain the balance. In that sense, we are no better than they.
The man says not a word in response. At that moment, Tomas is overcome by ravenous itchiness. It's all over his body now.
If you'll excuse me, I have business to attend to, he says to the shepherd.
He makes his way back along the footboard to the cabin. From the cabin, through the wide window, the back of the shepherd's head is plainly visible. Thrashing and twisting on the sofa, Tomas battles itchiness, digging hard with his fingernails at his insect tormentors. The gratification is intense. The shepherd never turns around. To block out the rain, Tomas covers the shattered door window with a blanket, securing the blanket to the frame by closing the door on it. The rain becomes a monotonous drumming on the roof. Amidst the scattered supplies, he makes a space for himself on the leather sofa, covers himself with another blanket, and curls up tightly. He wakes with a start. He has no idea if he has slept 5 or 55 minutes. The rain is still falling, but the shepherd is gone. Peering through the machine's rain-streaked windows, he can see a hazy gray shape up ahead on the road. It is the flock of sheep. He opens the cabin door and stands on the footboard. The shepherd is in the middle of his flock, looking as if he is walking on a cloud. The dog is flitting about, as it did earlier, but Tomas can no longer hear it. The flock moves down the road, then flows off to one side of it, taking a path into the countryside. Through the rain, Tomas watches the flock get smaller and smaller. Just as it begins to disappear beyond a ridge, the shepherd, a black dot now, stops and turns. Is he checking for a lost sheep? Is he looking back at him? Tomas waves vigorously. He can't tell if the man has noticed his farewell. The black dot vanishes. He returns to the driving compartment. There is a small package on the passenger seat. Wrapped in cloth are a piece of bread, a chunk of white cheese, and a tiny sealed earthen jar of honey. A Christmas gift? When is Christmas exactly? 4 days away? He realizes he's losing track of the days. At any rate, what a kindness on the part of the shepherd. He is touched. He eats. It tastes so good. He can't remember ever having eaten such savory bread, such flavorful cheese, such delicious honey. The rain stops and the sky clears. While waiting for the wintry sunshine to dry the road, he lubricates the machine with drops of oil. Then, impatiently, he sets off. When he reaches the edge of the small town of Ares, he enters it on foot. He is pleased to find a proper apothecary.
I'll buy your whole stock. I have horses that are badly infested with lice, he informs the man behind the counter once he has produced the usual small bottle of Moto Naphtha.
You might want to try Hippolyto, the blacksmith, the apothecary says.
Why would he have any of the stuff?
Horses are his concern, including horses badly infested with lice, I would think. And what about your feet?
My feet?
Yes, what's wrong with them?
Nothing's wrong with my feet. Why would anything be wrong with them?
I saw the way you were walking.
My feet are perfectly healthy.
Walking backwards through the village on his perfectly healthy feet, Tomas finds Hippolyto's smithy down a lane. He is astonished to discover that the blacksmith has an enormous barrel of Moto Naphtha. Tomas is dizzy with joy. The supply will not only glut the automobile with fuel, but will also soothe his ravaged body.
My good man, I'll buy lots of it. I have 12 horses that are badly infested with lice.
Oh, you don't want to use this stuff on horses? That would be doing them a great disservice. It's very harsh on the skin. You need a powder that you'll mix with water.
Why then do you have so much motonaptha? What's it for?
For automobiles. They're a new device.
Perfect! I have one of those, too. And as it happens, it desperately needs to be fed.
Why didn't you say so?
Says the jovial rustic.
My horses were on my mind, the poor beasts.
Hippolyto the blacksmith is moved by the drama of Tomas's 12 afflicted horses, and goes into tender, lengthy details about how the lice powder should be mixed with warm water, applied topically, allowed to dry, then carefully brushed and combed out, starting at the top of the head and working one's way back and down across the horse's body. It's a task that takes much time, but a horse deserves nothing less than the best treatment.
Bring your horses, and I'll help you do it,
Hippolyto adds in a burst of fellow equine love.
I'm not from these parts. I only have my automobile here.
Then you've come a long way searching for the wrong remedy for your horses. I have the powder right here. 12 horses, you say? 6 cans should do you, 8 to be safe. And you'll need this comb and brush kit, the highest quality.
Thank you. You can't imagine how relieved I am. Tell me, how long have you been selling motonaptha?
Oh, about 6 months.
How's business?
You're my first customer. I've never seen an automobile in my life. But it's the carriage of the future, I'm told, and I'm a smart businessman, I am. I understand commerce. It's important to be up to date. No one wants to buy what's old. You want to be the first to spread the word and show off the product. That's how you corner the market.
How did you get this enormous barrel all the way up here?
By stagecoach.
At the word, Tomas's heart skips a beat.
But, you know, Hippolyto adds, I didn't tell them it was for automobiles. I told them it was to treat horses with lice. They're funny about automobiles, those stagecoach drivers.
Are they? Any stagecoaches coming soon?
Oh, in the next hour or so.
Not only does Tomas run back to the automobile, he runs forward to it. When he roars up to the smithy in his uncle's Renault with the alarm of a bank robber, Hippolyto is surprised, stunned, aghast, and delighted at the throbbing, clanging invention Tomas has brought to his shop.
So this is it! What a big, noisy thing! Quite ugly in a beautiful sort of way, I'd say. Reminds me of my wife,
yells Hippolyto. Tomas turns the machine off.
I completely agree. I mean, about the automobile. To be honest with you, I find it ugly in an ugly sort of way.
You may be right,
the blacksmith muses, perhaps pondering how the automobile will wreck his commerce and way of life. His forehead wrinkles.
No, well, business is business. Where does the motonaptha go? Show me.
Tomas points eagerly.
Here, 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 and here.
He has Hippolyto fill the fuel tank, the barrel, and all the glass bottles of vermin lotion. He eyes the bottles hungrily. He sorely wants to empty one all over his body.
Come again,
cries Hippolyto, after Tomas has paid for the fuel, the 8 cans of lice powder for horses, and the comb and brush kit of the highest quality.
Remember, from back to front, starting at the top of the head and working your way back and down. Poor creatures.
Thank you,
shouts Tomas as he speeds away. After Ares, he turns off the road onto a well-marked track. He trusts that his map, with its faint markings for secondary roads, will lead him back to the road beyond the larger town of Nisa, which he is hoping to circumvent by this deviation. From that track he turns onto another, then another. The quality of the tracks goes from bad to worse. There are rocks everywhere. He navigates the terrain as best he can. The land, meanwhile, rises and falls like heaving swells, so that he can never see very far around him. Is this how Father Ulysses felt sailing to the island, closed in while in the wide open? In the midst of his oceanic meanderings, the track simply vanishes. The directed smoothness of a pathway is replaced by a rockiness that is uniform and undefined, as if the track were a river that opened onto a delta, casting him adrift. He navigates on, but eventually he hears the voice of Prudence, and it urgently suggests he reverse his course. He turns the machine around, but facing one way looks no different from facing another. He becomes confused. Surrounding him in all directions is the same countryside, rocky, dry, silent, with silver-green olive trees as far as the eye can see, and bulbous white clouds boiling up high in the sky. He's lost, a castaway, and night is coming. Finally, it is not this predicament of being lost that leads him to drop anchor for the night. It is another, more personal one. Great armies of tiny vermin are rampaging over his body, and he cannot stand it any longer. He reaches a rise in the land and halts the vehicle, tapping its front against a tree. The air, fragrant with the fertile labor of trees, is extraordinarily soft. There is not a sound around him, not from insects, not from birds, not from the wind. All that registers upon his ears are the few sounds he himself makes. In the absence of sound, he notices more with his eyes, in particular the delicate winter flowers that here and there brave the stony ground, pink, light blue, red, white. He doesn't know what kind of flowers they are, only that they are beautiful. He breathes in deeply. He can well imagine that this land was once the last outpost of the storied Iberian rhinoceros, roaming free and wild. In every direction he walks, he finds no trace of human presence. He wanted to wait until he reached a private spot to take care of his problem, and now he has found it. The moment has come. He returns to the automobile. No human being, no being of any kind, could stand such itchiness. But before slaying his enemies with his magic potions, he gives in one last time to the gratifying indulgence of scratching an itch. He raises his 10 fingers in the air, his blackened fingernails gleam. With a warlike cry, he throws himself into the fray. He rakes his fingernails over his head, the top, the sides, the nape, and over his bearded cheeks and neck. It is quick, hard, spirited work. Why do we make animal sounds in moments of pain or pleasure? He does not know, but he makes animal sounds, and he makes animal faces. He goes, ah, and he goes, ooh. He throws off his jacket, unbuttons and removes his shirt, tears off his undershirt. He attacks the enemies on his torso and in his armpits. His crotch is a cataclysm of itchiness. He unbuckles his belt and pulls his trousers and his underpants down to his ankles. He scratches his hairy sexual patch vigorously, his fingers like claws. Has he ever felt such relief? He pauses to bask in it. Then he starts over again. He moves down to his legs. There is blood under his fingernails. No matter. But the vandals have regrouped in the crack of his ass. Because there, too, he is hairy. He is hairy all over. It has always been a source of acute embarrassment to him, the forests of thick black hair that sprout from his pale white skin all over his body. That Dora liked to run her fingers through his chest hair always comforted him, because otherwise he finds his hairiness repulsive. He is an ape. Hence the care with which he has his hair cut, with which he shaves. He is normally a clean and neat man, and modest and reserved, but right now he is unhinged with itchiness. His ankles are constrained by his trousers. He kicks his shoes off, pulls his socks off, tears one pant leg off, then the other. That's better. Now he can lift his legs. He attacks the crack of his ass with both hands. On he battles. His hands fly about and he hops from one foot to the other. He makes animal sounds and he makes animal faces. He goes, ah! And he goes, ooh! It's as he's working his pubic patch, his hands vibrating like the wings of a hummingbird, his face displaying a particularly simian grin of satisfaction, that he sees the peasant, just a short way off, looking at him. Looking at the man hopping about naked, scratching himself madly, making animal sounds next to the strange, horseless cart. Tomas freezes on the spot. How long has the man been watching him? What is there to do at such a moment? What can he do to salvage his dignity, his very humanity? He removes the animal expression from his face. He stands upright, as solemnly as he can, with quick dips to gather his clothes. He walks to the automobile and disappears inside the cabin. Profound mortification brings on complete immobility. When the sun has set and the sky is inky black, the darkness and the isolation begin to weigh on him, and full-out, unqualified, comprehensive humiliation is not a remedy against vermin. He is still covered in rioting insect life. He can practically hear them. He cautiously opens the automobile door. He peers out. He looks about. There is no one. The peasant has gone. Tomas lights a candle stub. He has nowhere to place the candle where it will not risk damaging the plush interior, so he unplugs one of the bottles of Moto Naphtha and corks it with the lit candle. The effect is attractive. The cabin looks cozy, truly a very small living room. Still fully naked, he steps out. He takes out the tin of horse lice powder and two bottles of Moto Naphtha lotion. He will do better than what Hippolito suggested. He will mix the lice powder with Moto Naphtha rather than with water, doubling the lethalness of the concoction. Besides, he has no water left. The water from the barrel in the cabin went into either him or the automobile. He has only a skin of wine left. He mixes Moto Naphtha and horse lice powder in a pot until the paste is neither too runny nor too thick. It smells awful. He starts to apply it to his body, working it in with his fingers. He winces. His skin is tender from all the scratching. The paste burns. But he endures it because of the death blow it is striking against the vermin. "Apply liberally," says the label on the bottle. He does. He does. After caking his head and face, he applies the mixture to his armpits and over his chest and stomach, on his legs and feet. He covers his pubic mound in a thick layer. Where the paste falls off his body, he applies double the quantity. For his rear, he places a great dollop on the footboard and sits in it. There. His head upright, his arms tight against his body, his hands spread out over his torso, he sits very still. Any movement, even breathing, not only loosens the paste but increases the burning. This burning is infernal. He tries to get used to it, but he can't. It's as if the paste has consumed his skin and now is working through his flesh. He is being roasted alive. But so are the vermin. They and their eggs are dying by the thousands. He needs to endure the agony only a little longer until they are all dead. After that, he will be well on the road to recovery. He continues to wait, slowly sizzling. Then it happens. A shattering boom! He is projected from the footboard as much by surprise and fright as by the force of the explosion. He turns and stares, the vermin and the pain all forgotten. The automobile is on fire. Where before there was only a single wavering flame atop the bottle of Moto Naphtha, now there are great patches of fire all over the inside of the cabin. And upon feeling a prickling at the back of his head, he realizes that the fire has leapt from the cabin onto his head. In a moment it spreads to his beard, his chest, his entire body. Poof goes his pubic mound, now an orange forest of flames. He screams. Luckily for him, the lice powder is not flammable. but there are stabs of pain coming from his head, from his chest, from his penis, wherever the motonaptha-fueled fire has worked its way through lice powder and hair and reached bare skin. He hops about, slapping his hands all over his body, stamping the fires out. When he is done, he stands, smoke rising off him in a column. The automobile is still burning. He runs to it. On the way, he picks up off the ground the wet blanket that he used the previous day to cover the broken cabin window and keep the rain out. He dives into the cabin, throwing the blanket around and flinging horse lice powder about. He manages to extinguish the fires. He pulls the trunk out from the cabin and opens it. Father Ulysses' diary, for being inside it, is undamaged. He nearly cries with relief. But the cabin, the state of it, the leather of the sofa, charred and crispy, the side panels scorched, the ceiling black with soot, all the windows except the one in front of the driving compartment blown out, shards of glass everywhere, the food, the motoring supplies, his clothes all singed and burned, everything covered in ashes and carbonized horse lice powder, and the reek. He finishes the last of the red wine, clears the driving compartment seat of broken glass, then lies down naked on the blanket on the seat, covering himself with the mink coat. Pain racks his body. His uncle yells at him in his dreams. He is chilled by the night, while yet burning from his sores. In the morning light, he dresses gingerly. However carefully he puts his clothes on, they rake at his tender skin. He sweeps and cleans the cabin as best he can. He opens the trunk again to check the diary. He does not want to lose his connection to Father Ulysses. He has come to see in the priest a man perfected by his suffering, a man to be imitated, because to suffer and do nothing is to be nothing, while to suffer and do something is to become someone. And that is what he is doing. He is doing something. He must strike onward to the high mountains of Portugal and fulfill his quest. But he is confronted with an unexpected problem. The tree right in front of the automobile. There's not enough space to drive around it. He has not encountered this situation until now. Always there has been space in front of the vehicle to make use of the steerage wheel and move forward. He exclaims and blames and curses. Finally, he tries to think of a solution, and there is only one, clearly, to cut down the tree. There's an axe among the store of essential items in the cabin. He has just seen it, covered in soot. His ever-considerate and far-sighted uncle no doubt included it for this precise purpose. The grand march of progress apparently includes the unfortunate necessity of chopping down every obstacle in its way. But the tree is so large, the trunk so thick, his body so sore. He dithers. Finally, the sight of his trunk of papers in the breezy cabin focuses his scattered energies. He picks up the axe. He stands facing the side of the tree opposite where the automobile is held prisoner. He raises the axe and swings. He chops and chops and chops. The bark flies off well enough, but the pale flesh of the tree is rubbery and resistant. The axe, sharp though it is, bounces back, producing only the smallest indentation each time. Hitting the same spot repeatedly demands a skill that mostly eludes him, and every swing grinds tender flesh against harsh clothing. Quickly he is bathing in perspiration. He rests, eats, goes at it again. The morning is spent in this fashion. Then the early afternoon slips by. By late afternoon he has hacked a large hollow into the side of the trunk. The hollow goes beyond the midway point, but the tree doesn't seem to feel any inclination to fall. His palms are shredded red and bleeding. The pain in his hands barely masks the pain he feels in his whole body. He is so exhausted he can barely stand. He can chop no longer. The hindrance has to go away now. He decides to use the weight of his body to make the tree topple. Placing one foot on the edge of the mudguard and another on the edge of the hood, he reaches for the first branch. It's torture to grip the bark with his hands, but he manages to hook a leg around another branch and heave himself up. After all his struggles with the axe, the comparative ease with which he climbs the tree cheers him. He moves out along a bough. He holds on to two separate branches. Of course, when the tree falls, he will fall with it, but the height isn't great, and he will brace himself. He begins to swing his body back and forth, ignoring the excruciating pain that is radiating from his palms. The head of the tree dances and dances. He expects to hear at any moment a sharp crack and feel himself drop through the air the short distance to the ground. Instead, the tree gives up with quiet, rubbery elasticity. It tips over slowly. Tomas turns his head and sees the ground coming up. The landing is soft, but his feet slip off their bough, and where they come to rest on the ground is the precise spot where the tree chooses to press down with its heaviest limb. He yelps with pain. He wrenches his feet free. He moves his toes. No bones are broken. He turns and looks at the automobile. He sees in an instant from the ground what he didn't during his long hours of toil standing up. The stump is too high. The automobile, its bottom, will never be able to reach over it. He should have chopped much lower. But even if he had, the tree is still attached to the stump. It has fallen over without breaking off. The point at which tree and stump cling to each other is twisted and will be even more resistant to the axe. And even if he did manage to chop through the rest of the trunk, and supposing the stump were shorter, would he be able to pull the tree away? It seems scarcely imaginable. It's no bush. His efforts have been futile. The tree mocks him. Still entangled in the branches, he slumps. He begins to sob awkwardly. He closes his eyes and abandons himself to grief. He hears the voice just before a hand touches his shoulder.
"My friend, you are hurt."
He looks up, startled. A peasant has materialized out of the air. Such a bright white shirt he is wearing. Tomas chokes on his last sob and wipes his face with the back of his hand.
"You've been thrown so far," says the man.
"Yes," replies Tomas.
The man is looking at the automobile and the tree. Tomas understood him to mean how far he was projected from the tree, which in fact he hasn't been at all. He's in the tree, like a bird in its nest. But the peasant meant from the automobile. He must think that Tomas crashed into the tree and was projected from the vehicle into its branches.
"My hands and feet hurt, and I'm so thirsty," Tomas says.
The peasant wraps one of his arms around his waist. Though short, he's a powerful man, and he lifts Tomas off the ground. He half carries him to the automobile, setting him down on the footboard. Tomas massages his ankles.
"Anything broken?" the man asks.
"No, just bruised."
"Have some water."
The man produces a gourd. Tomas drinks from it greedily.
"Thank you for the water and for your help. I'm most grateful. My name is Tomas."
"My name is Simão."
Simão gazes at the fallen tree and the automobile's broken windows, burned-out cabin, and many dents and scratches.
"What a terrible accident! Such a powerful machine!" he exclaims.
Tomas hopes Simão doesn't notice the axe on the ground.
"Pity about the tree,"
Simão adds.
"Is it yours?"
"No, this is Casimiro's grove."
For the first time, Tomas looks at the tree not as an obstacle in his way, but as a being in its own right.
"How old was it?"
"By the looks of it, 200 to 300 years old. A good one, producing plenty of olives."
Tomas is aghast.
I'm so sorry. Casimiro will be very angry.
No, he'll understand. Accidents happen to all of us.
Tell me, is Casimiro somewhat older, with a round face and graying hair?
Yes, that would describe Casimiro.
As it would the peasant from last night, the one who watched Tomas's vermin dance. Tomas suspects that Casimiro will see the events in his olive grove in a different, less forgiving light.
Do you think the machine will still work? Asks Simão.
I'm sure it will, replies Tomas. It's a solid thing, but I need to move.